Are you worried that another market collapse, like the ones we experienced in 2000 and 2008, could constrain, alter, or permanently delay your ideal retirement? If so, give us a call and request our complimentary booklet entitled Common Sense Investing, Removing the Risks from Your Retirement. In it, we'll show you how you can 100% guarantee your retirement portfolio against loss while still participating in market gains. In fact, many of our clients have experienced gains of 30% or more over the past 4 years while being 100% guaranteed against loss. Stocks, bonds, and real estate are all at record highs. And if it keeps going, great, you'll keep going up with it. But if it doesn't, and we're on the cusp of another big crash, your retirement plans won't be affected. Call right now and get our complimentary booklet called Common Sense Investing, Removing the Risk from Your Retirement. And like our most well-known client, Dory Monson, says, go from retirement hoping to retirement planning. So call now for your free copy at 866-779-RISK. Again, 866-779-RISK.
Opinions expressed in this program are for general information purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.
Welcome to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham on AM 770 KTTH. Whether it's preservation of capital or an aggressive growth strategy, every investor needs a clearly defined risk profile. Know Your Risk Radio is brought to you by Bulwark Capital Management, helping families navigate the ever-changing and often treacherous financial markets. Know Your Risk Radio starts now. Here's your host, Zach Abraham.
All right, welcome back to the show, and thanks as always for joining us. This is a new one today. We got a special guest, and it's not Dory. This is a real special guest to go along with our interview cycle that we've been doing, and we've actually got him in here in the studio with us, Tobias Carlisle. So welcome, Tobias. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be in a real soundproof booth. I'm used to the podcasts, which are on somebody's table.
Yeah. Well, we've done a few of those. Trust me. But yeah, and you're actually the first in studio, rather than Dory, of course, first in studio guest. So that's a big deal for us too. Usually we're just getting these guys on the phone.
I'll set the bar high.
Yeah, there you go. Perfect. Perfect. So the reason we've got you on the show is, and the listeners are going to be rolling their eyes because we talk about risk management and value investing. And I started following you on Twitter because you were talking value and you and I can probably agree that's not the hottest topic these days.
It's been tough.
Oh, man, isn't that true? But anyway, you've written several books. We've got four titles. And the newest one, though, Acquirer's Multiple. And the funny thing about this is right after our last interview with Mark Yusko, we were just talking about this off the air with Julian Robertson. And Julian was great at all forms of investing, but an incredible value investor himself. And I think it was on your Twitter page where I ran into Acquirer's Multiple and I was reading the description of it and I went, I got to interview this guy. So give us a little, now I don't want to ruin it. I'm sure you're probably better at describing the book than I am, but give us just a little overview of what the book is about, right? What we're getting at here, and B, kind of how you've come to this value investing approach that you've taken that is so out of favor now, right? What is it? Did I read somewhere it's 11 years now of underperformance of value?
It feels like it. I don't think it's quite that bad, but it could be nine.
Or whatever.
It's close enough that it's...
It's felt like 100.
It's a lifetime.
Oh, man. But anyway, so walk us through the idea of the book, how you came to it, and then kind of give us... So it's coming from somebody else's mouth. I want to hear I want to hear you talk about value investing and the genesis of the book.
I started out as a lawyer. I was working in mergers and acquisitions. I started in the early 2000s. So what we saw a lot of was dot-coms that had raised a lot of money and that were burning cash. So no real business plan.
Right.
And it had kind of been a decade of venture capital being very hot and big hot IPOs and then very strong stock market performance. And nobody had really done much in the way of activism for a decade. I don't think it was even called activism at that stage. But we saw these guys sort of start coming out and attacking these little cash box, basically, .coms that had terrible cash burn, and they'd get control and they'd basically stop the business. Uh-huh. And that was how, and then use that to buy another company or just pay the money out, just liquidate it. And I had read security analysis, and I'd read Warren Buffett's letters, and I knew that he liked a wonderful company at a fair price. That's what he says right. about his kind of investment. And I looked at these companies, and I just couldn't understand why they wanted to buy these companies. That they were literally, you know, not literally burning cash, figuratively burning cash, might have been literally burning cash.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to understand it. So I went back to security analysis, and I read, there's some later chapters where they talk about liquidations and getting control and activism and rights as shareholders. And so I started thinking and investing like that for my own account while I was a lawyer. 2006, Joel Greenblatt wrote a great book, The Little Book That Beats the Market, most successful book about value investing over the last decade. And I read it and I thought it was a phenomenal book, phenomenal distillation of what Warren Buffett was talking about in his letters. He sort of gave this quantitative, simple approach to kind of doing what Buffett did. And I tried to do it. I wasn't doing it very well. And I just had this idea that maybe the problem was that it was finding these companies right at the top of their business cycle. So what Buffett is looking for, when he says a wonderful company, he wants something that's making a lot of money for the money that's invested in it. And that sounds like a great idea, but I've seen businesses cycle. You know, they can make a lot of money at the top of the business cycle, and they can lose a lot of money at the bottom of the business cycle. They're expensive at the top of the business right. cycle. They're cheap at the bottom of the business cycle. And I thought maybe a better way of going about this would be just to find them cheap rather than cheap and good. And when I test that, so I partnered with, he was a PhD student at the Booth School of Business, which is sort of the best quantitative business school in the States, maybe the world. We went and found all these different fundamental methods that academics and industry people use to assess companies, and we tested them all again, and we tested the magic formula, and we found exactly that if you take away that wonderful company, that quality metric, you get better returns. Now that makes no sense other than what I've just described. It doesn't really make sense. So I wrote another book called Deep Value, basically exploring that idea, the mechanics of what makes it happen. How do they get back to valuation? They're just sort of expensive, quasi-academic books that not a lot of people have read. And I thought, I've been speaking about the idea, and I just wanted an inexpensive, simple book to sort of describe exactly what I was doing. And that's The Acquirer's Multiple.
Gotcha. Okay. And that, now, did I just see, I've got, and I'm kicking myself because I should have ordered the hard copy and brought it up here and gotten a signature, but I buy everything on Kindle. Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, I'm going to have you sign the Kindle. And how long ago did you start writing the book?
This one?
Yeah, the Acquirer's Multiple.
The Acquirer, it was, I wrote it fairly quickly. It was sort of it's like a 6-month effort.
Kind of a labor of love.
Very much so. Yeah.
So basically what this is you, all the research, all the learning you've done, and just kind of distilling it down to your philosophy, basically.
Exactly right.
Now, what is the biggest thing? I read some excerpts from it. I haven't finished it. But what is the biggest thing? And I find myself, I love hearing somebody else talk about this, because I find myself looking at these situations all the time, these different companies, where I sit there and I go, okay, looking back, I can see where this company had a great run. You can tell there's some good management. Maybe they've made a misstep here or there. What are some of the characteristics you're looking for? Because I found out, I didn't go to a very big prominent school, went to a local school here. And I joke with my clients that I didn't get my degree in value investing from a school. I got it from value traps, right? Learning that difference between, you know, that's cheap, it needs to be bought, versus that's cheap, it's going to get cheaper, right? What are some of those things that you're looking for? How do you dig through that? And what are some of the earmarks of, this is a value stock as opposed to this was a good stock?
I don't think there's any other way to learn about value stocks than buying them and getting your fingers burnt off.
Oh, man, I know.
I don't know that going to Columbia is a great university, and I love to have done the value investing program. That's where Benjamin Graham taught, and he was the father of value investing. And it's sort of it's where the value mafia really come from. But how do you avoid these things? So we use some statistical methods to identify some of these things. So the things that hurt fraud, that really hurts. There are statistical ways of identifying that. Earnings manipulation is sort of a first step down the road towards fraud.
Sure.
And we're not finding all of the cases. There are some sophisticated frauds out there that just don't get turned up, but you're catching some of them, enough of them that it probably makes a little difference. And then financial distress is another big one. And that's often the first step to sort of earnings manipulation and fraud as well. If you're not financially distressed, there's no real reason to be playing with the finances, you know?
Right.
If you do all of those things, you get slightly better performance. But the sort of things, I think it's just common sense often. You know, if they have a lot of cash on the balance sheet, then you've eliminated a lot of the risk with that company in the business model sense, because they have enough time to kind of right the ship, figure out what they're doing. If they can't do it, they can pay out some of that cash. You've got a little bit of a buffer there. And I like, you know, positive cash flow is nice. That solves a lot of your, you know, that gets right to the nerve issue with the business. I love to see them buying back stock. That tells you that management recognizes that the company is undervalued, is taking steps to sort of at least capitalize on that undervaluation, and they're thinking about the shareholders, which are all things that I love to see. If you find those things, I'm less interested in how much money it's making on its assets than are they sort of doing the things that I would do if I was in there? If anybody who's sort of honest and competent that they would do if they were in there. If you find all of those things together, I think there's a pretty good chance that something good is going to happen. Not in every case, but as a portfolio, that generates pretty good performance.
That it actually reminds me of the description of how Buffett came to acquire Berkshire Hathaway itself. A pretty similar story. We laid out pretty similar earmarks, and I'm forgetting. Where was that story laid out? I'm forgetting what book I read that in.
What's in? You'll find it in Acquirer's Multiple.
Oh,
too.
You tell so that tell story that, in I there too. Okay, I haven't gotten that part.
So before Buffett was running Berkshire Hathaway, he ran his hedge fund, and he was basically a corporate raider activist in his hedge fund, and he went he talked to various brokers, and a broker said to him, "I've heard this company trade. It's a net, which means that it's trading at a discount to its liquidation value. We think it's worth about $20. You can buy it for about $7. You can get in there, you can shut down the business, and you make three times your money. That's a pretty good deal." And Buffett said, these things are hard. You know, he'd already been burned in two other instances where he'd got control, and then the townsfolk in this little country town, when the newspaper had kind of turned against him, and he didn't want to go through that liquidation. And the guy said, "Well, he does this. The man who runs this thing, Seabury Stanton, does this periodic buyback, where he goes and buys all of these shares so he can sort of cement his own shareholding in the company. So you buy ahead of one of these buybacks, and then you just sell into the buyback, and you're done." And so Buffett starts soaking up a lot of the shares. He goes to meet Seabury Stanton. Seabury Stanton says, "I'm going to do one of my buybacks. Would you be interested?" And he says, "Yes. Well, if you're going to do it soon, I'm all in. If it's going to be in a few years' time, I'm not really interested." And he says, "Well, we'll do it. We'll do it soon. We're going to do it at $11.50. It's a great return for Buffett." Buffett goes back to Omaha. He gets the letter from Seabury Stanton saying, "Oh, we're going to do it at 11 3/8. Yeah. And he's so offended by that 12.5 cent discount that they've applied to his shareholding that he says, "Well, I'm not going to sell. Now I'm going to take over the whole thing."
Yeah.
So he gets control, and that's Berkshire Hathaway.
Now, just thinking about this, a little bit off the reservation, where did you do this research? Where did you get the details of a lot of this stuff?
That one in particular comes from a great biography about Buffett called The Snowball.
Okay.
A lot of them are stories that have just, they're reasonably well known among value guys. It's just that you have to sort of go to so many different places to find them. I've got some, because I, being a lawyer, I love kind of old documents. So I always, if I can find an old original document, I kind of grab it and tuck it away and wait for that time when I can include it in a book, which is sort of what my books have tended to be. They're like, I find some old technique that people have forgotten about, find the original guy who was doing it and tell that story and sort of explain how they were making money. A lot of those things, those opportunities have gone away, but I think if you think in those terms, you find a new way of doing something that people aren't doing.
If you like what you're hearing and you want to hear more about this stuff, we try to diagnose what's really going on. You can go to knowyourriskradio.com, hop on our podcast page on iTunes, and listen to our other shows, the other interviews we've got. I think obviously I'm biased, but I think there's some great information on there. The other thing you can do, give us a call, 866-779-RISK. Again, 866-779-RISK. And hang with us. We got a great show coming up, a lot of great information. Appreciate you tuning in. This is Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH.
Zach said he had a guest who wasn't me, but you can't get rid of me that easy, Zach. And I'll admit, Tobias knows a lot more about this stuff than I do. And I'll tell you who else knows a lot more than I do about all of this. And that is Zach Abraham, the guy you're listening to right now in Bulwark Capital. And that's why I'm a client with Zach. And the market's been doing great. Been a nice 2017. Zach's clients have done fantastic, but also Zach has strategies. So if we have that inevitable correction, or heaven forbid, even a crash, and we don't know when it's coming, but we know that all these things run in cycles, and we could have a correction in next week, could have it next month, we could have it sometime next year. Zach has strategies to help guide you through those inevitable cycles that come in the markets. And he's put it all together in a 12-page booklet, complimentary. He'll get that out to you. All you have to do is get hold of Zach Abraham, Bulwark Capital. Go to knowyourriskradio.com. You really owe it to yourself, your family, your portfolio, and just you being able to relax a little bit through the turbulence that's always part of these markets. See what Zach can offer you. Go to knowyourriskradio.com.
Are you worried that another market collapse, like the ones we experienced in 2000 and 2008, could constrain, alter, or permanently delay your ideal retirement? If so, give us a call and request our complimentary booklet entitled Common Sense Investing, Removing the Risks from Your Retirement. In it, we'll show you how you can 100% guarantee your retirement portfolio against loss while still participating in market gains. In fact, many of our clients have experienced gains of 30% or more over the past 4 years while being 100% guaranteed against loss. Stocks, bonds, and real estate are all at record highs. And if it keeps going, great, you'll keep going up with it. But if it doesn't, and we're on the cusp of another big crash, your retirement plans won't be affected. Call right now and get our complimentary booklet called Common Sense Investing, Removing the Risk from Your Retirement. And like our most well-known client, Dory Monson, says, go from retirement hoping to retirement planning. So call now for your free copy at 866-779-RISK. Again, 866-779-RISK.
You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management.
One of the things we talk about all the time is, you know, the returns with quote-unquote value investing may have not been, you know, up to par over the last 8, 9, 10 years, whatever it is. But really, when you distill it down, investing, there is no other form. I mean, really, right? And everything else is just fad. So now, again, my listeners are going to be rolling their eyes going, okay, here he goes again. In an environment like this, right, one of the reasons why we want to have you on there, exactly opposite of what we're talking about in the acquirer's multiple, exactly the opposite of what you're laying it down, you know, what you're laying out. And that's why I think the book is, the timing for it is perfect. How do we survive these times? What are we looking at? What kind of, what would the acquirer's multiple suggest that we do during these times and when it is so hard to find value?
The way that the acquirer's multiple is constructed, and I have a free screener on the website, acquirer's multiple of the it looks at the largest 1,000 companies and finds the cheapest 30 according to that metric.
And that's acquirersmultiple.com.
.com, exactly. Yeah. So there's always going to be some, in a market as big as the States, you know, those three stock exchanges, 22,000 companies, there's always enough to fill a portfolio a few times over that are very undervalued. The challenge is going to be when the market genuinely crashes, which the market's probably overdue and it's very, very expensive. That's probably coming at some stage. When that happens, it's no really great protection to be in undervalued companies. They say correlations go to one, which means everything falls at the same.
Yeah, 2008, same, right?
And valuation is not a great way to identify shorts. There's some research that says that if you're shorting on a valuation basis, so you think something's very expensive and you think I'll short that because it's very expensive. David Einhorn has this great line where he says 2 times overvalued is silly, but 3 times overvalued or 4 times overvalued is sort of no more silly. You've already left gravity. You know, you're no longer, there's no more silly than that. So there's no reason why it can't go 3, 4, 5. And you can find countless examples in the current market.
Oh.
Tesla, Netflix, maybe Amazon.
That might be running out of town.
Snapchat. Yeah. Well, Snapchat's come back a lot.
Yeah.
I sold that at the right time.
Yeah. No, we talk about that all the time. And on the radio, we equate it to distances traveled, right? If we're talking about a trajectory from here to the moon, right, and we're off half a degree, you're going to be off massively. You know, we stretch out. But at a certain point, whether we're off, you know, if we're off the path, in the beginning, right? If our trajectory is off half a degree or 3 degrees in the beginning, it doesn't really matter, right? We're just off the path. And that's one of the, it's funny to hear you bring that up because that's one of the analogies that we talk about all the time. And that's sort of where I feel like we are, right? I mean, the market we're living in is pretty much the antithesis of what you're writing about.
But you're always going to encounter these sort of markets. So you need to find a way to deal with them. And that's as a young value investor starting out in the early 2000s, and I started investing seriously in about 2007, which was great timing because I put everything in and then I saw it go down 60% or whatever it was. I realized that you have to find a way to deal with it. So the way that I deal with it is we run a long and a short portfolio. So the long portfolio is undervalued companies that are like the ones that I just described, ideally with some sort of the other things that I know that private equity firms and activists like, because then you get them coming in and buying the company and pushing up the stock, doing various things with it. On the short side, it's a slightly different approach. You need to have problems with the company, problems at a fundamental level, not just overvaluation.
Right.
You sort of need, the company needs to be struggling at a business level. It needs to be carrying too much debt so it can't adjust itself to deal with those issues. You know, often you'll find they're struggling on their statistical, they're struggling on the financial distress, they're struggling on earnings manipulation. There's something going on. And if you buy a portfolio of those, they do tend to underperform the market. Not every year. The issue with shorting is you can have quite a large concentrated position long. You can't do that with short positions. They have to be much, much smaller on an individual basis.
Right.
Because any one of those can go up materially, and then that can blow a big hole in your portfolio. And you have to think about, you know, with a short position, if it goes bad, the worst thing that happens is it goes to zero.
Yeah.
You can lie in your bed with your covers over your head and, you know, never have to do anything. With a short, you have to make up your mind at some stage.
Where do I cut bait? Yeah.
What do I do? So yeah. I think a better way to sort of approach it is to be, I'm rolling them constantly, trimming them back. So hopefully they're making money, but often if they're not, they're just going up. But the position's never getting any bigger in the portfolio.
Right. No, it's reminds me of what Bill Fleckenstein says. You know, he's got all these criteria for a short, but he says at the end of the day, I like to shoot him in the back. Right.
Right.
I want to make sure the problems have come to the surface at that point.
Big fan of Fleck.
Yeah. Oh, I know. He's a local guy too. He's actually one of the guys I want to get on here eventually if we can land him. Do you approach the short side of it though with because it's more nuanced, right? I mean, the short side of it's more nuanced. But are you using the same overlay? Are you using the same criteria to determine and identify each? I mean, is that kind of what you're looking for?
I have a basically,
and not try to ask you to give away your trade secrets.
No. Yeah. But basically, what you're saying is right. It's just that valuation is less sort of important in shorting than all of the ugly stuff. But you know, on the long side, I just want to make sure they're not doing the bad things, and it doesn't really matter if they're, you know, if they're really, really not doing them, it sort of makes no difference. As long as they're not doing them, I'm happy. On the short side, the uglier it gets, the better the short is, hopefully. And I, you know, I don't know if a lot of guys talk about this or not, but a lot of value guys, but you don't want any momentum in the stock. You don't want the stock going up when you're trying to short it. You short them, like Flex says, you want to shoot them in the back. You shoot them when they're dead.
Yeah.
Just walk over and put the last bullet in their head.
Yeah, and just ride them right to the bottom, right? So now when you're running on the long short side of it, and now I want to get back to the book here, but just I love picking other guys' brains to do this. And we don't I don't do any shorting in retail accounts. But when you're doing it, are you looking at 50-50? Are you approaching it as a straight split? What's the portfolio composition look like?
The nature of the market is that it tends to go up. It's up about 70% of the time. So you want to be long biased for the most part. And we are trying to make our money on the long side.
So it's an alpha approach then. I mean,
right.
Okay.
So we're mostly long. We're mostly long value investors. But a way to get longer is to put a little short on. And so the shorts vary between 25% of the portfolio up to 75% of the portfolio, sort of depending on a few factors, how many of them there are around that kind of meet those criteria. It's a funny thing that the shorting in this kind of market is tough because there's so much liquidity around that businesses that in another market might have been shot much, much earlier, you know, might not have made it to the watering hole because they died in the desert halfway there. Yeah. Here, there's water everywhere.
Yeah, I know, they're swimming.
Right.
Now, one of the things that we've dealt with, now I'm saying this because for my clients out there listening, we've got a bona fide author here with us. And so I'm looking for you to back up our approach. But how do you deal with these long periods of underperformance? You know, I get, and I don't hide it. You know, I've said right on the radio show before, look, one of the things that we've dealt with, especially, and I've watched it really pick up in the last 6 to 8 months, and we got great clients who've been really patient, but they've said, you know, why aren't we getting in on this? And why aren't we getting in on that? And I just, you know, we go through this, hey, this is the approach. We stick with the long haul. How do you endure these long droughts?
It's a great question. And that's, I mean, part of that is why I wrote Deep Value, just to say, you know, we're not just buying ugly companies because we don't know what we're doing. We're doing this for a reason. You know,
right.
I'm not buying these other companies. We're not just, you know, I can see that they're all going up and everybody knows that they're going to keep on going up until they don't. And then they're going to come back hard, you know, when they do. Value investing has been a very good strategy over the very long term. But one of the reasons that it keeps on working is that it has these periodic periods like this where it doesn't work, and they can be extensive. This is an exceptionally painful one because it's been so long.
Oh.
The last period that was like this was the late 1990s. It was much shorter and sharper and deeper, but it didn't. It was sort of, I think it started in 1996 and it was over by the end of 1999. 3 years is a long time in a lifetime, but in the stock market, it's nothing. This one, sort of, when it actually started. So in my personal opinion, when I look at the back test, when I look at the testing, I think it started in June 2009.
Okay.
And if you started as an investor on that date, your returns doing exactly the same thing would be pretty materially below where the market is now. But you can start at different dates through that period and your returns will look better. So if you started in the beginning of 2013, that was a good time to start because value had a pretty good catch-up year.
Yeah. Yeah.
2015 was bad. So value really underperformed in 2015. You might not have caught up yet. 2016, very good year. 2017, bit of a middling year. So it's sort of, there's a lot of randomness in the returns to value. I often wonder whether judging against the market, and I realize that's an absolutely legitimate place to be judging because you can go and invest in the market for virtually nothing. You can get 4 basis points, you can be in an ETF that tracks the broad market.
I know where you're going and I love this, right? Okay, yeah.
So what do we do that justifies a higher fee than that when we underperform? I think that we're doing something that is time-tested that over the very long run will outperform. And so if your investment horizon is 20 years or 30 years, which most people who are sort of earning, they have longer investment horizons like that. At least if you're in this sort of strategy, there's a rationale for doing it.
Well, and this is what, I love the fact that you went here. I want to go here later, but if you like what you're hearing, and you want to hear more about this stuff, we try to diagnose what's really going on, you can go to knowyourriskradio.com, hop on our podcast page on iTunes, and listen to our other shows, the other interviews we've got. I think obviously I'm biased, but I think there's some great information on there. The other thing you can do, give us a call, 866-779-RISK. Again, 866-779-RISK. And hang with us. We got a great show coming up, a lot of great information. Appreciate you tuning in. This is Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH.
Zach said he had a guest who wasn't me, but you can't get rid of me that easy, Zach. And I'll admit, Tobias knows a lot more about this stuff than I do. And I'll tell you who else knows a lot more than I do about all of this. And that is Zach Abraham, the guy you're listening to right now in Bulwark Capital. And that's why I'm a client with Zach. And the market's been doing great. Been a nice 2017, and Zach's clients have done fantastic. But also, Zach has strategies. So if we have that inevitable correction, or heaven forbid, even a crash, and we don't know when it's coming, but we know that all these things run in cycles, and we could have a correction in next week, could have it next month, we could have it sometime next year. Zach has strategies to help guide you through those inevitable cycles that come in the markets. And he's put it all together in a 12-page booklet, complimentary. He'll get that out to you. All you have to do is get hold of Zach Abraham, Bulwark Capital. Go to knowyourriskradio.com. You really owe it to yourself, your family, your portfolio, and just you being able to relax a little bit through the turbulence that's always part of these markets. See what Zach can offer you. Go to knowyourriskradio.com.
Are you worried that another market collapse, like the ones we experienced in 2000 and 2008, could constrain, alter, or permanently delay your ideal retirement? If so, give us a call and request our complimentary booklet entitled Common Sense Investing, Removing the Risks from Your Retirement. In it, we'll show you how you can 100% guarantee your retirement portfolio against loss while still participating in market gains. In fact, many of our clients have experienced gains of 30% or more over the past 4 years while being 100% guaranteed against loss. Stocks, bonds, and real estate are all at record highs. And if it keeps going, great, you'll keep going up with it. But if it doesn't, and we're on the cusp of another big crash, your retirement plans won't be affected. Call right now and get our complimentary booklet called Common Sense Investing, Removing the Risk from Your Retirement. And like our most well-known client, Dory Monson, says, go from retirement hoping to retirement planning. So call now for your free copy at 866-779-RISK. Again, 866-779-RISK.
You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management.
The benchmarking, right? We're all benchmarked against the S&P 500. Yet at the same time, if we sit here on the radio show today and people are driving around in the car listening, and we go, who's the greatest investor ever, right? We all know what they're going to say. Warren Buffett, right?
Julian Robertson.
Yeah, Buffett. That's true. Yeah, yeah. And what are Buffett's annualized returns if you go all the way back? Isn't he right around 30, 31, something like that?
So he's come back. I think he's sort of, he might be almost 20, I think. Since the very beginning to date, it's almost 20.
Okay, yeah, and he's gone back and forth. So, but the whole run to passive, right? I'm kind of grouping a lot of things in here. But this whole run to passive indexing is all based off of, hey, the S&P is going to return 11% like clockwork. You got to do it. And then all these people that do that strategy and take it, you ask them who the greatest investor of all time is, and they tell you Buffett.
Right.
And yet we have these big divergences between the performance of the S&P and then value investing. But I think you really make a great point, which is I've always sat there and wondered, why can't we come up with an index or some other benchmark for value investors? Because we know over the long period of time it outweighs and it outperforms, But over these short runs we've got, you know, you've got this, I always laugh because I refer to it as the Buffett indicator, which is as soon as value investing is dead and Warren Buffett's an idiot, you better get into
value. That's the time to invest.
Yeah.
Well, I don't mind being benchmarked against the stock market. That's a good, if you're over a very long period of time, I think that a value investor should be able to just like quantitatively buying undervalued stocks over a long period of time does outperform the market. That's not been true for the last 7 years. Why has that not been true for the last 7 years? Because this tends to be a momentum market that's clustered in a few very big, very fast-growing businesses. But we've seen this kind of market before. We saw it in the late 1990s. saw it in the 60s. They come around periodically. When they come around, that doesn't mean that I want to abandon something that's worked so well for 100 years.
Right.
If anything, that makes me think, I know that these periods don't last forever. This is going to come back hard at some stage. And when it does, I want to be the guy. I'll take 5 years of underperformance to be the guy standing there when it turns around. You catch up very, very quickly as a value guy.
Yeah, because it will. And it tends to be an environment when value goes on a run, everything else tends to get punished right at the same time. And I especially hope our clients are out there listening to this that were griping and complaining for the last 4 years as we held GM. I took a beating over that one. But we finally had a little bit of a run here.
Well, I think that was probably a good idea. Einhorn identified as undervalued, very, very good value investor.
Oh, when he came out and said he was long GM, you better believe the emails start flying around to the client. See, I'm not nuts here. But it brings up a great point that, I mean, sitting on these things can be painful for a long period of time, even if you're not losing. Just that performance differential where people are getting restless.
The FOMO.
Oh, God. And it's easy to do on the investor side of it, too. I'm sure you've got some stories about, you know, you and I are probably, I mean, I grew up on this stuff, right? I mean, I was probably learning about Benjamin Graham and Warren Buffett before I knew how to do algebra. But for those people that aren't in the world of investing, the reason you've come to this is because, like you said, you've backtested it. It's what's worked the best, right? I mean, you didn't just pick up a value hat one day and say, this is what I want to be.
I've tested it extensively, and it happens that the acquirer's multiple is the best tested back, the best strategy and back test, but you don't have to do the acquirer's multiple. You can take cheap on a price earnings basis, cheap on a price to book basis, price to cash flow. Take your pick of any of those sort of cheap relative to a fundamental has worked really well for as long as we can look at back test data.
Now, I'm going to sound a little ignorant when I say this, and the listeners are probably like, well, what's new? And just as a reminder, for those that have just joined us, we're interviewing Tobias Carlisle, the author of the recent book that was just recently released, Acquirer's Multiple. And the reason we had to have him on is because this is the mantra that we're preaching all the time about deep value stocks versus momentum stocks. And so when we were talking about that, we were just getting into this, the Acquirer's Multiple, the name of the book, but also the name of the style, the model that you follow, correct?
So the way that I found the idea was looking at the little book that beats the market, which is the great Joel Greenblatt book, where he looked at the return on invested capital. And on the other side, he used earnings yield. So I'm just basically using an inverse of that. I do a few other things with that little algorithm to sort of make it perform a little bit better, things that make sense to me. So not that I want to bore everybody, but if you're trying to calculate operating earnings, which is one of the inputs into the model, that's basically what the money that the company actually makes from its own business. It's sort of the accounting equivalent of cash flow. Mm-hmm. Cash flow is reconstructed from the financial statements, but I prefer operating income as my sort of my measure. If you construct that from the top of the income statement down, so you're looking at revenues and then you're taking away the cost of goods sold and a few other bits and pieces, you get a more honest answer than if you try to reconstruct it from the bottom. You know, the very top line is the truest line in the financial statements, and the very bottom line is the least true but probably most relevant. So you're trying to find some balance between those two where it's an accurate reflection of what the company is doing, but it's also truly what they're earning, what they're able to sort of decide what they're going to do with. Are they going to invest it into the business? Are they going to pay it out as a dividend? Are they going to buy back some stock? And that's the decision that you want to see the company making. And if they're making the right decisions, then that's a company that you want to own. If they're making the wrong decisions, you're hoping that an activist is going to come or a private equity firm is going to come in and buy them out. But you still might want to own it. I wouldn't say no because management's behaving badly if it's cheap enough.
Right.
If it's really, really cheap, then that's just catnip to good activists and private equity firms.
Right. Now, during the process of writing the book, because I can't even imagine the amount of research that went into it. I'm probably research for the book and research you've done over the last 20 years, right? What was the most intriguing thing to you that you found or that you ran into? You know, maybe it was a guy's model that he used or a way he looked at things. What was the thing that was the most interesting to you about the process?
There are a few things. When I first started out as a lawyer, I was saying this earlier, I like to collect these documents. And one of the documents I collected was some research out of a firm that was in, I think they were based in Silicon Valley, and they were seeing the same phenomenon that I was seeing in the law firm, where these there were lots of these cheap companies. They were pretty good companies, but they couldn't get any attention. And they were being approached by these new investors who were buying them or trying to get control of them. They couldn't really, there was no name for them at that stage. They weren't known as activists. But a few of these guys like Dan Loeb, David Einhorn got their start around that time. So I've got a few of these documents. I discussed them in Deep Value. I didn't bring them so much into The Acquirer's Multiple just because it's supposed to be a simpler book and easier to read. But that was, at the time I sort of grabbed them and I thought this would be really interesting, and I completely forgot about them until I went to write Deep Value, and it was sort of 14, 15 years later, and I thought, oh my God, this is like a little bit of a premonition of what I was going to do. I can't believe I held on to this.
Yeah. No, that's fascinating. Then another part in the book is you got a section on Michael Burry in there, right? And did you interview him at all, or did you talk to him at all when you did that?
I wish.
Yeah, the way he looks at it is, he approaches it like a doctor, which isn't surprising. At least that was my read on, you know, some of the stuff that he looked at. But the line I love that he used that's always cracked me up, and then I read it again in your book, was I'm probably going to botch the exact line, but it's something like, I like to find companies that look like roadkill. Right.
I love that approach. That's exactly what I try to do.
Yeah.
And then they just, you polish them up a little bit and they kind of survive. Icahn says the same thing. Like he wants to buy it when it's as appetizing as roadkill.
Yeah.
And that's why I think about it. And that's the reason that I wrote the book, because I had clients who would look at it and say, what are we doing in these things? And the funny thing is, if you're a value investor, you see, you know, things that were incredibly attractive only 2 years ago. So this is a story I've been telling recently. Gilead, G-I-L-D is the ticker. That was one of the most popular stocks. If you go and look at any of the blogs, type in that ticker, Gilead, people loved that stock, and it ran up to $120, something like that. Mm-hmm. June 2015 was the peak at $120. And it's fallen by almost 50% to June 2017. So 2 years later, absolutely hated, despised, no friends anywhere. All of a sudden, it's really, really cheap.
Yeah.
So I think I don't have any particular view about the business. I think it's a pretty good business, but it's a deep value stock, so I really don't have to have a view. It was trading at like 3x on an acquirer's multiple basis.
Wow.
Which is like a 3x PE, roughly sort of the way you can think about it. So I bought it. Everybody's saying this thing's, you know, it's down 50%. It's going to keep on going down. Could entirely possible that could have happened. It happens that didn't happen. It recovered. It got up in the high 80s. It's actually come back a fair bit. Now, I think it's very, very cheap still. It's still in the acquirer's multiple screener, the free screener on the website. It's sort of the fifth or sixth. You're not paying very much for a really good business in there. And it's one thing that you put it in there in 2 years' time, that will be an expensive business that you'll want to sell.
Yeah.
And you'll think, what was the reason for buying? Like everybody will be piling into that stock and saying, I can't remember. Why would you buy it when it was cheap? Why would you sell it now?
Yeah, well, and I'll confess, I think everybody should go to that acquirersmultiple.com website and check out that screener, because I'm going to start integrating it. I've played with it a little bit the other day, and I went, wow, this is pretty. It does a lot of the legwork for you. And
the amazing thing is, so it pulled up Apple last year. I never thought that I'd see Apple come back into that screener again. It's just one of those things. Like, I'm happy not to buy some stocks. I'll just never get cheap enough for me to buy. Yep. And it came into the screen, and it was sort of the 30 stocks in the screen, it might have got into the 25th or 24th. And I had to have to buy it at that kind of level. And I tweeted about it, because I had tweeted about it in 2013, saying this, it's crazy that this is one of the cheapest. And everybody says, oh, you know, that no one's going to buy the next round of iPhones, whatever. That's kind of, it's so cheap that I don't really care what the business is going to do at that stage. So I bought it. Lo and behold, Icahn turns up with a big shareholding in it.
Yeah.
I cheered pretty loudly when that happened.
Yeah.
And then again in 2016.
Well, and then Buffett jumped in.
Well, in 2016, I said last time it got this cheap was 2013. I just retweeted what I had tweeted in 2013.
I think that's when you caught my eye on Twitter. I think it was somewhere around there, yeah.
And then Buffett popped up in the stock.
Yeah.
So that was fun.
Yeah, no, that was a classic, I mean, a shorter time horizon. I wish they all happened that quickly. But we had gotten out of Apple. And you know, same thing. It got down there. We didn't get the bottom. I think we started buying it at like 102, 103 or something like that.
And it
pressed. Well, didn't it get down to 89, 88, something like that?
I don't think it quite got down below 90. I think it got into a 90 handle.
Yeah. And just everybody, you know, it was one of those things where if you pay attention to the value side and you go read a book like Quire's Multiple and get that in your mind frame, when everybody's bashing it, it's the way I talk. I'm probably ripping this off somebody else, but it's the old adage, just because something's down 90% doesn't mean we're going to buy it, but it does mean we're going to stop and take a look.
Well, that's good.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was where, you know, we'd sworn off Apple. I'd been begging on Apple for years just because, you know, and then it got down there and I thought, oh, now we got a shot at something.
I've got another one that I always bear in mind too. What do you call a stock that's down 90%?
A stock I own.
So that's a stock that was down 80% and went down 50%.
Yes, yes. Which was...
That's Einhorn.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And he was talking about... what stock was he referring to?
I'm not entirely sure. It's possible he was taking a shot at Ackman. I'm not sure.
Oh, yeah. That's probably what it was. Yeah. Well, which reminds me, we saw that firsthand in the gold market in the last... since 2011, I think it was the GDX dropped 90% and then it dropped another 50% from there.
Yeah,
it was
just reverse compounding.
Oh my goodness. Thank goodness we had the good sense to stay out of the way and not catch that falling knife. But that was a brutal run. Now what is the time space between these books when you're writing these books? Now you said the Acquirer's Multiple was easier for you because it was kind of, you know, a compilation of all the things that you've learned and that you've studied. Well, what kind of time frames and study time are you putting into these books and research time?
They tend to be about 2 years apart. The funny thing is every time I release a book, I have another child. So I'm a little bit nervous because I've got one due in a month and that'll be 3 children and 4 books.
Oh, wow.
So there's no more children.
No more children. Yeah, I was going to say, your wife's probably sitting there going, we got to slow this book schedule down a little bit, right?
She's the one who said no more children.
Yeah, that's right. She's the one paying the price. She's paying the Acquirer's Multiple
she,
on
she
your...
Is,
yeah,
she
yeah.
Is.
That, that's,
poor
yeah,
thing.
Yeah. God bless her, huh? Okay, now, on the management side of it, again, I don't want you to give away your trades.
No, I'm going to give them all away.
Okay, fantastic. But for the people at home, and for me as well, you notice I'm going to be sitting here scribbling madly while you're talking. What are some of those things that you see out there right now, other than the obvious that they hear me going on and on about all the time, as far on the value side? Because one of the places we've been looking a lot is retail. It's brutal. And, you know, on the flip side, on the overvalued stuff, you know, we've got the obvious, the Snapchats. Kind of give me an idea, or is that not the way you approach it? Are you...
So we have two portfolios. So the special situations portfolio, that's we come at that from value, and we also approach it from the catalyst. So if there's a merger that's sort of a little bit broken, we might go and look at it. In the quantitative value portfolios, which is sort of what we're talking about now, I look in that screen, and this is something that you will see. Retail will all cluster in there at the same time. Mm-hmm. Airlines will all come in at the same time, and if you're the quants who do this stuff from a sort of academic, more quantitative perspective, I approach it as a value investor who just sort of happens to do some of it systematically. They would say you want to control your exposure to an industry. I say you want to embrace those industries when you get that chance to buy a whole lot of them and spread your risk a little bit in that industry. And I think that sort of concentration in an industry drives a lot of return. So it makes sense to buy a basket of retail when it gets cheap. It makes sense to buy a basket of airlines when they got cheap. So that was another fun thing. I did a talk somewhere last year and somebody in the audience said, I've noticed that your screener is full of airlines. How would you approach that? Would you buy them? Because airlines are a famously bad investment. And Warren Buffett has said, you know, he's only really ever lost money on airlines.
Yep.
And he said something like, If he had been an investor at Kitty Hawk when the first plane fell, he might have shot it out of the sky.
Well, and he held that mantra for his entire career up until...
Last year, he bought a whole lot of airlines. And I got that question before, uh, before it was revealed that he had bought a whole lot of airlines. So I felt good about that. I felt like the screen had actually got there at about the same time Buffett had.
Well, and not just him. Bill Miller went big into airlines about a year and a half ago, too.
I think that's a little secret about Buffett, that he does talk about the wonderful companies at fair prices, but I do think in his heart of hearts, he's still a really deep value guy, and he likes to see them crushed before he sort of gets in there. He's a little bit like Fleckenstein saying, you know, he just wants to be the guy to put the last bullet in them.
Yeah, yeah.
So airlines were very, very cheap. Apple was very, very cheap. These things do get very, very cheap. And, you know, management doesn't just stand there and let them sort of wither away to nothing. They know that they're pretty good businesses. They do things. And the market sort of forgives them over a period of time and they recover.
Yeah, no, it's, and the other thing too is it can be painful. It can take time. But there is nothing better than being the ultimate contrarian and finding this just dirt-covered pile of garbage that nobody wants.
That's
right?
Why we do it, right?
Oh yeah. Well, it's either that or we like pain. I'm not sure. Over the last
bit of both.
Yeah, I'm a bit weathered over the last eight years, whatever it is. On the retail side, have you looked into any of those names specifically? Anything you're interested in?
I still have Walmart. So I don't know if that actually made it into the screener, but I like Walmart. I think Office Depot has been beaten up a little bit recently. Looks pretty interesting. I'm going to be confused because I look at the tickers. I'm not sure whether it's Best Buy. I'm never sure whether it's BBBY or BBY.
It's
BBY.
This one gets me all the time.
Bed Bath & Beyond is BBBY.
Yes. Yes. Okay.
But I like Best Buy, which is BBY.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
The one you want.
Well, yeah, and Best Buy, gone on a tear.
It has had a pretty good run.
Is it still pretty cheap though?
If you can pick your spots, you can find some cheap stuff. So Dillard's, I think, is kind of interesting too. Mm-hmm. DDS is the ticker there. I think it's one of those things that it's cheap. They got some cash. There's a controlling family. That something could happen in there easily.
Yeah, there was actually some, we were looking at some retail plays in the UK, and there were some remarkably cheap. We were probably halfway through the investigatory process, but there were some remarkably cheap plays in the UK on the retail space side of things.
It's a little bit outside my purview, but the other thing that I think about that is worth mentioning in the context of retail, it's something that Buffett has said. New concepts do tend to come into retail and they can destroy legacy retail. So that's why these things have got particularly cheap this time. He tells a story about the when department stores first started, when they first appeared, they needed to be very close to transportation so people would come in and get off. And then if your store wasn't close to that sort of transportation, you were just out of business basically.
Oh, wow.
So there is genuine risk that Amazon does eat all of these things, but Amazon is very, very expensive. Yeah. Retail is very, very cheap, and you never get things cheap unless people are genuinely worried about the future of the company.
Right. No, and that's why I think the timing of the book is perfect, right? And for those of you who don't know, we're talking to Tobias Carlyle here, the author of Acquirers Multiple. They can get it on, they can do what I did, get it on their Kindle on Amazon. They can order the
paperback
book. Yeah. Paperback.
And Kindle.
How far along, again, I've never written a book, so how far along do we have to get to get a hardback?
So I've, the other three books that I've published, they came out in the in hardcover first, and
okay.
they come out at $85 for a hardcover version of these books. And so I self-published this one. I wanted something that everybody could get. I wanted to set a low price for it because I wanted the story to get out there because I think it's a good message that you don't hear a lot of. So I self-published, put a low price on it, $9.99 on the Kindle and $15.99 for the paperback.
Yeah, no, and I would encourage everybody to go read it too because if you want to, you know, like I said, I thought the timing of it was perfect because if you want a quick read, Well, and if you want a quick read and you want a more condensed version, not everybody's going to sit down and read security analysis, right? It's just not going to happen.
And I've tried to do that. I've read. This is one of the. If you're a real value geek, you have a few copies of security analysis and you have your favorite copy of security analysis. So I have. I am a real value geek. I've got four copies. So they say.
Oh,
that
wow.
The 1934 edition is for the real connoisseurs, and you can get the, you know, a reprint of it. I don't have an original edition, just the reprint. And then the 1954 edition, people love that one. And then a very recent one where they've got all these new, they've got good investors from today who've written about it. The very first one I read was the 1934 edition. That's a really, really hard book to read.
Oh, I can only imagine. Yeah, I think that's the one edition that I've got. I think I inherited it from my grandfather. I'd have to go back and look at it.
You'd almost give it up if you read that as your, that was the first thing.
It was brutal.
I was lucky that I had read Buffett's letters to that point, because if I hadn't read Buffett's letters, I wouldn't have become a value investor, because security analysis was too hard.
Oh, it was like, I felt like I was back in ninth grade algebra or something. I mean, it was just banging my head against the board.
And it's all about bonds, railway bonds.
Right.
Where do you find railway bonds?
It's not a hot commodity these days. Well, anyway, thanks so much for joining us. And we got to run, but I can't emphasize that enough. People can go to acquirersmultiple.com, the website. And I would encourage all of you, go buy the book and educate yourselves buy two. You can even buy three and send another one to me and I'll get it autographed, or you can send it to Tobias. I'm sure he'll do that too, right?
Absolutely.
And yeah, but reacquaint yourselves with this value idea. We talk about it all the time on the radio. And listen, it's not if, it's when. And you're going to be sitting there kicking yourselves going, oh, I should have paid attention. I should have gotten back into value investing. And then also check out the screener at acquirersmultiple.com. It's just a wealth of knowledge. So thank you, Tobias, for joining us. And also, Carbon Beach, so I don't want to leave this out either. You don't just write about this. You practice it. Carbon Beach Advisors, is that?
Carbon Beach Asset Management.
Asset Management.
CarbonBeachAM.com is the website.
Okay. And it's a accredited investor? Or
we have accredited. We're investigating launching an ETF. So hopefully that will be sometime in the next 6 to 12 months. That should be live, which will be an acquirer's multiple ETF.
Yep. And that will be something that will most likely work its way into our clients' portfolios, I can assure you. Yeah. All right. Well, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yo, you bet. Anytime. And thanks for listening. This is Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH.
Thanks for listening to Know Your Risk Radio. Whether it's preservation of capital or an aggressive growth strategy, every investor needs a clearly defined risk profile. Schedule your free risk review at knowyourriskradio.com. Tune in next week to Know Your Risk Radio with your host, Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management.
Zach said he had a guest who wasn't me, but you can't get rid of me that easy, Zach. And I'll admit, Tobias knows a lot more about this stuff than I do. And I'll tell you who else knows a lot more than I do about all of this. And that is Zach Abraham, the guy you're listening to right now, and Bulwark Capital. And that's why I'm a client with Zach. And the market's been doing great. Been a nice 2017. Zach's clients have done fantastic, but also Zach has strategies. So if we have that inevitable correction, or heaven forbid, even a crash, and we don't know when it's coming, but we know that all these things run in cycles, and we could have a correction in next week, could have it next month, we could have it sometime next year. Zach has strategies to help guide you through those inevitable cycles that come in the markets. And he's put it all together in a 12-page booklet, complimentary. He'll get that out to you. All you have to do is get hold of Zach Abraham, Bulwark Capital. Go to knowyourriskradio.com. You really owe it to yourself, your family, your portfolio, and just you being able to relax a little bit through the turbulence that's always part of these markets. See what Zach can offer you. Go to knowyourriskradio.com.